Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 280, recorded December 2nd, 2016, for January 2nd, 2017, Anne Marie Slaughter. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Betterment, a smart, easy-to-use, and less expensive way to invest for your financial future. For 6 months fee-free, visit Betterment.com. Welcome to Triangulation. I am Megan Maroney, filling in for Leo Laporte. Triangulation is a show where we talk to some of the smartest people in tech about what they're doing in tech. And I am thrilled to welcome Anne Marie Slaughter to the show. Anne Marie is president and CEO of New America. That's a think tank and a civic enterprise dedicated to renewing America in the digital age. Welcome, Anne Marie.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thank you so much. You, if people might know you, you were the first woman to be the head of policy planning at the State Department, at the Department of State, and you were the former dean of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, at an School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Some might also know you, and I know you hate to be introduced as the woman who wrote the article about why we can't have it all, but you, of course, wrote an amazing article for The Atlantic, Why Women Still Can't Have It All, and personally, that came at a time when I really needed it. My children, it was 4 years ago, so my children were young, and I was working, and basically, you know, a lot has been said about this article, but for me, what it said was, it's really hard to have a career and children, and it's okay for it to be hard, and we need to work to change the system in order to make it better for mothers and fathers. So thank you for writing that.
I should say, you're welcome. I should say, I don't mind. I love being introduced as the woman who wrote the article. The only thing I get upset about is the message of the article was not, you can't have it all. The message of the article was, we need to make a lot of changes to make it possible. So the still can't have it all was supposed to be, here's all the things we still need to do because it is so hard. And many people, though, read that as women can never have it all. Women can never have what men have. And that's where I say, no. My whole life is dedicated to the opposite proposition.
Exactly. And I think that that's what I took away from the article. It didn't make me back down from my career or my family. It was a story that I needed to hear because you said, you know, this is an unintentional lie that a lot of people are saying, like, I'm fine. Everything's fine.
Right. Exactly.
So let's start with the New America Foundation. What's the mission of the New America Foundation?
So we actually dropped foundation. We just call ourselves New America, which right now I'm feeling very good about because we need a New America. So New America mission is renewing America in the digital age. And it was founded in 1999 with the understanding that digital technology was going to revolutionize our lives in the same way that industrial technology had, and that as with the Industrial Revolution, when you have that kind of change, you upend the economic system and the social system, and that was going to create lots of problems, and we needed to be thinking ahead as to how we were going to remake the social contract, remake our economy, remake a lot of our institutions. And that's a long process. The digital revolution, you know, got started in the 1990s. We're still in the early phases. If you think about the Industrial Revolution, of course, it took a century or more to work its way through. And so what we exist to do is to really think big, about ideas beyond ideology. We have Republicans and Democrats. We don't even call them that. We think of just people who think from different perspectives. We're also all about combining technology and law. So if you're solving big problems like how are we going to remake our educational system? How are we going to get jobs? How are we going to have benefits and care for our families? the solutions are not only going to be legal, they're going to be digital. So we believe a lot in, we have actual software engineers sitting next to lawyers and policy experts. And the last thing we do is we really believe in being beyond the beltway, as we think a lot of American renewal is coming from cities and towns across the country after this election. A lot of people are very pessimistic. The sort of idea is, no, you know, we really are in a bad way. New America thinks actually there are a lot of problems to be solved. But if you actually go to a lot of the smaller cities around this country, you can see people taking hold and trying to fix problems while not waiting on the federal government.
Yeah, it really seems like this election has showed us that we are in a time when we're moving, really moving from an industrial society to an information society. And of course, you know, we used to be an agrarian society. And when we moved from an agrarian society to an industrial society, you know, we had a civil war and things were not so great. Do you think that something like that has to happen for us to really move from an industrial society to an information society?
I think it's impossible to get there without social and economic conflict. We certainly hope this time around that that won't be armed conflict. So the last time around, you're absolutely right. In the United States, there was a civil war. In Europe, there were revolutions across the continent. And then we had a world war. And a lot of that world war was in part, countries that were empowered through the Industrial Revolution. They had empires. They fought with each other. Of course, we also had communism. Marxism grew out of the poverty that the Industrial Revolution left, wreaked on so many factory workers. So I think it's impossible to make this kind of transition without conflict. But the question is, can we avoid, obviously, either civil war or, God forbid, global war? But the kind of populism we're seeing right now on the left and on the right in the United States, but also in Europe, that's the same kinds of movements you saw in the late 19th century. And at its best, it gave rise to progressivism. At its worst, it gave rise to some really nasty stuff, anti-immigrant parties, anti-black parties, the same kind of, you know, the world is falling apart and it's their fault that you're seeing again now.
I mean, I think we really see it in the tech industry just because the tech industry started with computers and hardware and making things. And now it's so much just information. And a lot of those jobs we see are going away. You know, we see truck drivers and, people in factories, and their jobs are really threatened by technology. But we seem to be moving that way. Is there any work that you all are doing to protect those workers, to figure out what's going to happen to all those workers that their jobs are going away by automation?
Well, we're certainly trying. And I have to say, when you look at people across the country, truck drivers are the biggest job category in the majority of states for men. And so you can imagine the uncertainty they feel. But even my sons, who are college educated, or at least in college, they don't know what careers they're going to have, and I don't know what to tell them. So if you think of that, even among people who are highly educated and privileged, then the uncertainty that many people feel across the country is completely understandable. We've got a project on the future of work. It's called the Shift Commission that we're doing with Bloomberg Beta on the future of work, workers, and technology. And we're looking at different possible scenarios. So I'll give you a more optimistic one, because there are plenty of pessimistic ones. The more optimistic one says a lot of the jobs we know now, whether blue collar or white collar, any job that can be automated will be. Any routine job that a machine can learn will be automated. But here are the jobs that won't be automated. Think coaching jobs. So already, if you think about life coaches, executive coaches, athletic coaches, in the arts. If you think about athletes have coaches for life, and a growing number of people in business are getting life coaches. And you think about therapists of all different kinds, physical therapists, but also mental therapists. And then you think about caregivers. And this, of course, intersects a lot of the other work I do. There's a care explosion. As the baby boomers age, 10,000 a day, we all need care. We desperately need care for our children because, of course, both parents are working. And so we need to enable families to care for each other, but also child care. So there's a big explosion in care jobs. And then finally, teacher jobs, because education is going to become lifelong. And lots of people are going to be able to teach in different ways without having to be in either colleges or universities or even schools that are now. So the most optimistic scenario we see is that instead of making things, people will be providing services to each other. But to make that work, you need things like portable benefits. You need family-centered benefits so people can pool their health care, their retirement benefits. So you need a very different structure of the way government and society provides for each other to make that scenario work.
And how do we get there?
Well, again, I mean, this is – I'm really serious that if you look at where we were in the late 19th century, it was laissez-faire government. I mean, there were not even regulation of the number of working hours, much less health conditions. You know, workers were completely exploited. We then had the progressive movement. We put in place a lot of things like antitrust to prevent monopolies from exploiting consumers and business. We put in the income tax to provide government with the means to create infrastructure. Then we had the New Deal, where we created things like Social Security and health benefits through businesses. That was enormous change. We're going to need a lot of the same kind of change. And the question is, are we going to do that? Are we going to create that change for all Americans? Or are we going to continue on the path we're on, where some Americans are doing extraordinarily well, you know, reaping the benefits of the information economy and the platform economy, and millions and millions and millions of others really don't see a future for themselves. So it's going to take really wholesale change. And I think a lot of people sense that. That's one reason I think they have voted first for Barack Obama, who promised, you know, hope and change, and this time for Donald Trump, who promised radical change, although in different directions.
So you talked about care and those caring jobs. Those are definitely skills that if people are thinking, what can I do? And you've said that caring is our most important work. That's a quote that you've had. One of our viewers, we were just having this discussion, said, you know, we're at our best when we're caring for each other, yes. Which is really true. And so there's been mumbles about universal basic income. It's something that's talked about a lot in Silicon Valley. You know, the idea of it's at its simplest is just that everyone would just be paid and, you know, goes along with the end of work. It sort of makes my head explode a little bit thinking about it. But do you think that is the future of universal basic income? Or do you think it should be?
I think it might be part of the future, but I have to say, the universal basic income proposals that I've seen are very basic. In other words, they would prevent people from being homeless. They'd give people food on the table, but they wouldn't support the kind of middle class lifestyle that people aspire to, much less the ability, you know, to really fulfill their potential. I also think the idea of a world without work is a terrible one. I mean, all of us need the sense of work to give us dignity and purpose and meaning. Now, that doesn't have to be paid work, right? You can invest in caring for your children or caring for your parents or volunteering in your community. There are lots of ways to have work that is fulfilling that doesn't have to be paid. On the other hand, again, a universal basic income is not going to pay enough. So I think you could imagine a universal basic income as a kind of floor to make sure that people really don't lose everything, but you'd still need to have an economy on top of that. And that is where, again, a lot of these teaching jobs, caring jobs, and caring, by caring, I mean investing in others. So I don't just mean providing physical care. And of course, you know, if you think of what we do as parents, physical care is just the beginning. It's teaching, it's discipline, it's investing, it's role modeling, it's knowing how to let go and push people to do for themselves. So I think there are a lot of jobs there that we would have to make possible for people to hold. That also means professionalizing a lot of those jobs. But I don't see a world in which people get enough to live from the government and have no work and are happy. That's not something we've ever seen in human history from hunter-gatherers forward.
Mm-hmm. So the caring skills, tech skills, obviously really important in the future. I mean, technology, and not just for people in college or people looking to get a career, but people already, especially in politics, it seems like tech skills, you really have to have them. I mean, if this election showed us anything, it's really important. Yeah. So how can you talk a little bit about New America is doing to help leaders with tech skills, and just can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think of tech as, again, the way we're going to solve public problems. Public problems are just, you know, how do we live together? How do we have healthcare? How do we have jobs? How do we have education? All the things that government provides for us. And we have traditionally done that through law. When I was growing up, if you wanted to make the world a better place, to be very idealistic about it, you went to law school. And you either ran for office or you worked in government or you worked in a non-governmental organization, but, you know, a civic organization. Today, we still need lawyers, but we need technologists just as much. We need people who can think about how to create a platform that will create jobs, or how to stop government from surveilling you, or how to hold government accountable, or if you're in government, how can you deliver government services efficiently using technology? And those people are what I call public interest technologists. Just like we have public interest lawyers, the people who argue great Supreme Court cases, but also the people, again, who pass laws or remove laws, depending on what needs to be done. We need technologists doing all those things. So New America is working with a number of other organizations and with government and with foundations and with some Silicon Valley investors to create a whole ecosystem for anybody who wants to make the world a better place through technology, who needs to earn a living, go to work for a tech company, and all companies will become tech companies, but who can then also take those skills again and work in government, work in civic organizations, work in private companies, but for the public good, what lawyers call pro bono work, where you're not charging, but you're doing important work. And we need that entire ecosystem from so you should be able to go and get a computer science degree and marry that with a policy degree. And you should be able to work for a firm, but then go into government, or as I said, go into a social enterprise or a non-governmental organization.
So do you imagine maybe like a Peace Corps, like a tech Peace Corps? Have there been proposals for something like that?
There have been. And in many ways, Code for America, that is the idea. And Code for America has fellowships where technologists can go and work in government. And they have many, many more applications every year than they have the ability to fund fellows. And we're working with them and with other people who are funding fellowships to increase that. But more broadly, absolutely. Imagine if you said, all right, we really need to jumpstart our economy. And when we did that in the 1930s, you had the Works Progress Administration. You put people to work building infrastructure across the country, which we could frankly do again based on our physical infrastructure. But imagine if we also said, yeah, we need lots and lots of people who know how to code, who can fan out and work with governments and work with small business and bring them into the digital age. So you could imagine a tech corps like the Peace Corps, which was abroad, or AmeriCorps, which is at home. And I think there's enormous potential there. It also has the advantage of diversifying the tech world, because frankly, you know, right now you look at Silicon Valley or Silicon Alley, it's not exactly diverse, but lots of people of color, from different minorities, women who think, hey, wait a minute, I can use these skills not only to make a great living, but to work on issues I'm passionate about in the public sphere. I think they would be much more attracted to coding careers and design and project manager careers, because it's not just all coding, of course.
I mean, because you really do see that in Silicon Valley, like you see the apps that come out and the services and the social networks that are really, like you said, they're often catering to that non-diverse workforce of people in Silicon Valley.
Yes.
And that, but then you do see like Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, Eric Schmidt and people, once they've gotten to a point in their career, in their you know, their service, then they start giving back.
Yes.
Is there a way to compel people earlier than that to be able to create these services that you're talking about, being involved in like a tech Peace Corps instead of making another app that lets you, you know, put unicorn ears on your head and take a selfie?
I love that image. Yes, you know, the fastest way to order pizza. So I think there is, and again, some of this is the initial culture of tech. Like, again, the culture of law. When I got into law in the 80s, you know, the traditional legal career had been you go work for a fancy firm and you help corporations figure out, you know, how to navigate the law. But then with the civil rights revolution, many people looked at lawyers and said, wow, the people that, you know, won Brown v. Board of Education or Loving v. Virginia or Roe v. Wade, all these great precedents that helped people get equal rights and really reach full citizenship, lawyers did that. So I think as people see that if you want to save the oceans, technology is going to be a huge piece of that. If you want to find ways to give people in systemic poverty ways out, finding education and training that is part tech and part interactive and human, that's going to be a big piece of that. If you want to work on any area of public interest, tech's going to be important. I think you're going to see people, again, going into tech to do that. I also think you're going to see people who are already in tech before they've made their millions thinking, you know, I want to do both. I want to be making the best living I can. Maybe I want my startup. But I want to be able to spend some time in government or working with a social enterprise or a non-governmental organization or a charity or whatever it is. And those skills will actually help me in my private tech career. So those kinds of career pathways are things we're mapping. We've seen some of the best engineers in Silicon Valley want to go into government after they figured out that, you know, engineers saved healthcare.gov, and they were able to give millions of people health insurance. And that actually is more fulfilling than simply creating the latest app. But people have to see that that's prestigious, that it's rewarding, that it's valued by people who are in Silicon Valley and in tech across the country. And again, that's a culture shift.
And obviously, a lot of this has to start way earlier for kids. I mean, right from the beginning. And we see, you know, we've been hearing about the digital divide for a decade at least or longer. But now, you know, it's coming up in different ways. Like most a lot of people just have mobile devices at home. People aren't having computers. So then a lot of the social services don't look, you know, you can't access them on a mobile device. It's coming up in all kinds of different ways, and especially in education and what schools are getting fast internet access and what aren't. Is there anything that you can talk about how we can change education policy to help with that?
Where do you start? Yes. So there are, again, many different ways. And this is where, you know, people like me from the point of view of just talking. Look, we have got a education system, K through 12, that was designed in the 19th century. It ends at 3 o'clock and we get out for the summer. This is insane. You know, this is not working. And there are, so really, I think in, you know, 10, 20 years from now, education will be far more personalized. Kids will still go to school in various ways. I'm not saying everybody's going to sit in their homes. I think that would actually be terrible. But it's going to be much more integrated with experiential learning. It'll be much more personalized. You will likely have people who have access, who go to school, who are online in school with teachers who are guiding them, and then also taking time out of school. So, you know, instead of the traditional field trip, actually kids being exposed to different careers much earlier. That's starting to happen in some high schools that will integrate apprenticeships of various ways. But what you really have to change is the idea that school is this thing you do K through 12, or if you go to college from 18 to 22, 18 to 20, 18 to 22. Instead, it's not school. It's education, and education is going to happen lifelong. So people are going to get re-educated many times in their lives, and they're going to intersperse that with work. It's going to come from many different sources. So if you think right now, you have a high school degree. In your town, there is a need for digital skills, coding, other skills. You can go to a coding boot camp or a other way of teaching you digital skills. You can then go directly to work for a corporation and Opportunity at Work, which is a wonderful program that works with Tech Hire, 60 cities actually across the country, where corporations have agreed to take these kids without a fancy computer science degree from a regular college. So this idea of education that's lifelong from many different sources, and then critically with measurable outcomes, because you've got to certify that you were actually taught something. So if you're a coder, you can put your code up on GitHub and your employer can see how good is your code. Not how good is your degree, but how good is your code. Or if you're a project manager, how effective were you at making something happen? Or if you're a designer. So really, this whole notion that education is something that happens in school is going to look as outdated as, again, you know, in the agricultural era, education was something that happened only in apprenticeships and then, you know, in one-room schoolhouses. So we're going to have to really retool it quite radically for the digital age.
Mm-hmm. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Betterment. Make sure you and your family are set for financial success with Betterment. Betterment is the largest independent automated investing service, managing more than $5.5 billion, over 180,000 customers. Their portfolio is designed to achieve optimal results at every level of investment. And there are no minimums to sign up. Betterment's goal-based investing framework and advice algorithm will let you know if you're on track in just seconds. Betterment's automated investing comes at a fraction of what you would pay for traditional financial services. You can save up to 6 times on fees, so you can keep more of your hard-earned money. There are no trade transaction or rebalancing fees. You can also securely sync outside investments with Betterment, so you can see your total net worth all in one place. Through diversification, automated rebalancing, and lower fees, Betterment customers can expect 4.3% higher returns than a typical DIY investor. Smart deposits allow you to automatically invest excess cash so you can keep your goals on track. Every time you make a deposit or receive dividends, Betterment will intelligently rebalance your portfolio. They'll do it all for you. Betterment's task loss harvesting will help lower investment taxes and increase after-tax returns. Their end-to-end investing means faster cash transfers, tax forms available at the earliest possible date, and secure investing. Support specialists are available 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Investing involves risk. Right now, get up to 6 months fee-free. To learn more, visit Betterment.com. That's Betterment.com. Betterment, investing made better. So let's talk about work-life balance a little bit. I mean, that you are the spokesperson for it, though that's not how you started out. You have given a voice to this in a really interesting way. Someone who had a very powerful career and still has a great career. But, you know, just you wrote the piece, as we talked about before, and admitted that we need to change the way the system works. Do you think technology is really helping working parents, or is it hurting in terms of being always connected and always feeling like you have to check in with work? Or do you think it's more helping because you can, you know, be at the soccer game or, you know, be on a business trip and talk to your kids? Which do you think is it helping or hurting?
So definitely both. The helping, obviously, the flexibility is huge, and not just that I can go home and the boss can still reach me at the soccer game, but, you know, the gig economy, the on-demand economy, when you ask people why they're in that economy, they so often tell you, this allows me to work when I need to work. And often those jobs, you know, if you're talking about a Uber or a Lyft driver or TaskRabbit, that may not allow people to make enough they can supplement their income, but it's hard to make a really good income. But when you start looking at white collar jobs where you can do a project based job, you can even in the world I imagine with teaching, you know, you can teach a course, you can offer whatever skills you have, really even quite high level skills on sort of on demand. That really can help people manage when they have caregiving obligations. But the other piece of it that is absolutely critical is a culture shift at work. Because as you pointed out, if the idea is, okay, I can be reached at home and that gives me flexibility, but that also means I can be reached 24/7, that's not quality time when you are at home. That burns people out. So what I think you're starting to see, at least at many businesses I know, is a culture shift that says, okay, I now can be reached, but only if it's really important. So at New America, we pretty much have norms. You don't email after normal business hours or on a weekend unless it's important. And then often what we do is to text to say, check your email, so that you don't have to be constantly tethered to your phone or to your computer. And, you know, part of what I argue in this book I wrote, Unfinished Business, is we have plenty of evidence that says that really getting real downtime, even when that downtime is, you know, there you're with your kids, you're it's not that you're not actively engaged or working or putting a meal on the table or putting them to bed or working with their homework, but you're changing it up. You know, your mind's doing other things, and that actually makes you more productive than working around the clock. And there are obviously jobs that will always have longer hours than other jobs, but even those jobs, you do need to have a break. Otherwise, you just can't be productive.
Well, yeah, you talk about jobs that that require longer hours, and there's also that jobs that have no temporal flexibility is the term, just like being a lawyer, being a CEO, like these jobs that are hard, harder for have in the past been harder for women because they have to be there. Right. And it, you know, the bigger question is, why isn't it also harder for men? Why the idea is that why aren't men are feeling that the same, that they want to be with their family too, instead of, you know, having to spend most of their time at work. And so you brought up the gig economy. And right. You would think that is the promise. Like these gig economy jobs are not, you're not a lawyer, you're not a CEO. But then you mentioned also that they often don't make enough money to support your family. It's very flexible, but you know, so can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, the gig economy and its effect on workers?
Yes. So the first thing to say is there is a white collar gig economy too, right? There are many, many, many platforms now where if you're a lawyer, you can work on a project basis. So you can get paid nearly the same you would get in a firm, but without being in a firm, you can work from home, or you can say, I'm going to take on this project and work very hard for this while, and then I'm going to take time off. That's true for coders. That's true for executives. There's actually in LA, there's a platform called Rent a Boss, right? So people who are just really good at getting things done. That's increasingly true for accountants, even for some medical jobs. So the idea that it can't be done white collar, that's not true. And then places like Upwork have any number of kinds of corporate jobs that, again, you can get on a freelance basis, and the freelancers union too. So this is something I think we're going to see in white collar as well as blue collar work. And it is very promising. But as you point out, as long as those jobs are for women when they have children, or women when they have to care for their own parents, that just deepens male-female inequality, because that's then, you know, the man still works full-time. The woman, you know, is working on a project basis. Actually, if you poll millennial men, Gen X men, roughly 50% of men say they feel intense work-family conflict, some or severe work-family conflict, and 56% of women. So it's not that different. That's good, because men need to push for this kind of flexibility too. The other thing is that millennials essentially have the attitude that they should be able to work anywhere, anyhow, anytime. And so they're pushing employers also to be more flexible. And that's important, because as employers compete for them, you'll see a change in working practices. But the key is for managers to say, look, this is the work I need done. I need it done by this time, and it has to be of this quality. And after that, it's up to you where and how you get that done. If you have meetings, you have to be at the meetings. But increasingly, people do go to meeting anyway, you know. And we all travel a lot, so we're checking in by video. But it's up to management to change that idea of this idea that the person who sits in the office longest is working best. Judge by results, not by presence.
Well, you wrote a piece in the New York Times in 2015 about the toxic work culture.
Yes.
And you said that there's good news, that it's changing, especially in the tech industry. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it is, and it is and it isn't. So on the good side, I think the tech industry is leading on things like family leave. And when people like Mark Zuckerberg take paternity leave, that sends a powerful signal. The idea that you can work from wherever you are is definitely prevalent in many startups and even the bigger tech companies. So there's a lot of potential there. That said, if you look at a lot of the big tech companies, they are campus-based. They provide everything there, from your dry cleaning to obviously your food to your leisure. They provide cleaning services at home. These are still campuses. These are still workplaces that are aimed at people without dependents, essentially kids, and many more men than women. And so partly I think we have to see those younger engineers and others, when they hit child, you know, family rearing age, Mark Zuckerberg's a good example, things may start to change. But partly, again, I think you have to tackle this idea that, you know, working round the clock is the best way to produce. I get it that, you know, when you're, I pulled plenty of all-nighters when I was in my 20s and 30s. And I get it that there's times absolutely where you have to get something done. You're on a deal. You're on a deadline. You're living on adrenaline and coffee. I get that. But over the longer term, over the arc of a career, that cannot be the standard.
Well, you write more about this in your book, Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family. So if anyone's interested in that, definitely check that out. It's available anywhere where books are sold, on the internet and off the internet. I want to go back real quick to our beginning, our discussion of just about where we are right now in America and divided as we are. And because New America really focuses on the digital age, can you talk a little bit about what role do you think social media plays in that? Facebook, Twitter, and just the amount of time people are spending there or other places on the internet, sort of siloed, as opposed to out with people, and how do you think that is playing a role in politics
Yeah, I think about it a lot, and I have to say, in the time that since I've been on Twitter, so since 2011, I have found recently that it's so divided that if I tweet anything that might invite actual political discussion, and when I was initially on Twitter, part of what I loved about Twitter was that I could engage with people who really were quite different from me. I often would get into discussions with people who had very different foreign policy views than I did. And part of what I valued is that they would disagree with me in a way that gave me a different perspective. Well, now, if you put something out like that, if you say anything negative about Trump, for instance, you just get slammed. And if you're a woman, all the more. But even, I think, men, it's not conversation. It's just hatred in a way that means people don't engage. And of course, we know people are siloed. You know, Eli Pariser wrote The Filter Bubble, four years ago now, that what all the social media allows us to do is create our own little world. I do think we've got to find something that is in between, you know, traditional news, where we're not ever going to go back to Walter Cronkite and everybody watch three networks, but there has got to be a way that people of multiple political persuasions, different demographics, can have some common base of both reality and conversation. And I expect that entrepreneurs in media are going to try to find products where what I still think is the vast majority of Americans, remember, independents are the largest single group of American voters. So take all the independents and a number of more moderates from both the left and the right, there I think is a real desire to reengage. But you simply can't do it on the platforms we're on now. And there again, there's got to be a product and technology that screens out trolls, that really blocks people who are only interested in shouting you down, but also fosters an ability to really engage with people who don't think like you. The other thing I think is going to that I think we are seeing, and I think there's going to be a hunger for, is people re-engaging physically in various ways. Whether, you know, there's tremendous residential segregation, and that's a large part of the political problem we have. But I've been thinking just about going back to my hometown and how many of us have left our hometowns. I don't mean going back to live, but finding ways to re-engage with people in my hometown, to get to get out of this, in my case, very liberal elite bubble that I tend to live in.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. I'll just end with a quote from you. You posted something on Twitter that was controversial. A lot of people going back and forth, and you waded in to it, and I'm always impressed. And you said, "I appreciate civil, respectful discourse across party lines. It's the only way we're going to save our democracy." So thank you for that. And, you know, it's like, I don't know if you thought, oh, I'm not going to wade into this. But like every time we think of, you know, if someone like you says, I'm not going to get into it, like, you know, that is a problem. So I thank you for that. And thank you for your work with New America. And thank you for spending the last hour with me. It was great to talk to you. And I look forward to seeing what New America does next.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation. Appreciate
Take care.
It. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Triangulation. Thanks for joining me. You can find out more about Anne-Marie Slaughter at newamerica.org. And Triangulation records every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific. And Leo Laporte will be back next week to host. Thanks so much for joining us.